Is your WordPress site fast? Get a detailed report of just how fast your WordPress site is and easy steps you can take to make it faster. Go to wpengine.com/speedy for your free speed test. That's wpengine.com/speedy. You are listening to Love Your Work. This show is going to show you how to crush everything in life and smack your to-do list in the face. I'm just kidding. This is Love Your Work. This show is going to help you define and achieve your own version of success. I'm David Cadavy. I'm an author, an entrepreneur, and a designer. And I've built a business and a lifestyle that fits my values, and I want to help you do the same. So that's why every Thursday, I bring you a new episode of this here show, Love Your Work. I seek out one-of-a-kind entrepreneurs and creators that break away from the pack, and I dissect their paths, and I pull out the lessons that you can use for your own journey. So learn how you can turn challenges into opportunities, how you can cut out the noise to focus, and how you can find the clues that will lead you to your calling. So check out Paul Bennett on episode 15. Interesting guy. He sailed around the world while running his business. Or Elise Bauer on episode 33, who bounced back from an illness to build a food blogging empire. And you also can't miss Jason Fried on episode 1 and former AOL CEO Steve Case on episode 25. And from time to time, I also bring on experts who will help you be more productive, creative, and healthier. So check out neuroscientist John Cunios in episode 8 and Ryan Holiday on episode 31, Dr. Terry Walls in episode 35. Thank you to all of you who have been heeding my call for reviews. We have new reviews. Amongst them, P. Dog Galawog, I don't really know how to say it, who calls it an excellent podcast for solopreneurs and also says David guides his guests effortlessly through the peaks and valleys of the mind. And I think that's a really astute observation because it's something I'm always trying to do is just kind of ride the contours and surf the mind of my guests. Alex Peterson says, I've been getting a ton out of these interviews. And that's a 5-star review. And hey, look, a review can be simple and short and sweet just like that. So just go to cadavy.net/iTunes and review the show. It helps a lot. And if you are already subscribed, then you are in luck because I have great guests coming up. I just interviewed world-renowned behavioral scientist, former colleague of mine at Timeful, author of Predictably Irrational and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, just fantastic books. Dan Ariely. Yes, Dan Ariely is going to be on the podcast. That's coming up way in November. So make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss that. I also have the Cards Against Humanity co-creator, Max Temkin, is going to be on, I think, you know, what, 2 weeks from now. So if you aren't subscribed, then hit that little subscribe button so you don't miss the great guests that are coming up. And we also have a great guest this week. I mean, we always have a great guest. Really, well, I mean, why do I even bother saying it? This week's guest is known for writing personal development advice that doesn't suck. Mark Manson writes at markmanson.net, which has more than 2 million readers a month. Mark writes about a variety of topics, including happiness, self-knowledge, habits, and relationships. And you've probably read Mark's work before. He's written some big hits like Fuck Yes or No, In Defense of Being Average, and an article by the same name as his upcoming book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And I love Mark's writing because it cuts right through the usual sort of self-help nonsense that you read that is going to make you think that all you need to do is just follow your passion and think positively and somehow everything is going to become, you're going to become magically successful and you'll just be a silhouette in front of a sunset on top of a mountain somewhere and everything will work out that way. Instead, what Mark does is he encourages you to see things as they are, to find comfort in discomfort, a theme that you see often in these interviews, and to accept that when you try to have it all, you really end up with very little. So this interview is great for anybody who's ready to face the hard truths in life and in pursuit of being the best version of themselves. So find out why Mark starts off his new book telling you, don't try. How can you find fulfillment and shut down unhealthy cycles in your life and relationships?
How can travel clean away your biases and insecurities? And if you are living or considering living the digital nomad lifestyle for a while, how does Colombia differ from Brazil? And how can you get the benefits of travel if you don't leave your hometown at all? And how does your lifestyle change when your values change? So here we go. Here is Mark Manson. This episode is brought to you by Treehouse. Take your career to the next level and learn from over 1,000 videos created by expert teachers on web design, coding, business, and much more. Claim your 14-day free trial at kadavy.net/treehouse. Right, I'm here with Mark Manson. And Mark, you have this new book coming out, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Now, I hear that title and I initially think, all right, that means that I'm just going to start like parking in handicapped spots and like taking extra napkins at the Chipotle or something. But so what does not giving a fuck mean to you?
Basically be like Steve Jobs, right?
Right. Park in the handicapped spot.
Apparently he used to do that. Yeah.
Which, by the way, is not funny, right?
I mean, except for the Chipotle, yeah. But he probably would walk in and take a bunch of napkins. Yeah, the whole thing about giving a fuck, it has this badass connotation of like just being this guy or this girl who walks around and does whatever they want and doesn't care about anything. But it's really, really what this book is it's a thinly veiled mask to get people to think about their values, to think about what they care about, why do they care about it, is it worth caring about, and just how kind of all of life's little issues and struggles stems from those questions.
Mm-hmm. So not to blow your cover or anything, but it sounds like it's a little bit of like a Trojan horse if people are going to buy the book and think like, oh yeah, this book's going to show me like how to not give a fuck, and then they're actually going to be self-reflective and self-aware.
By chapter three, they'll be crying, and yeah, it's no. I mean, it is. It's and you could kind of say that about my work in general. It's got this kind of like edgy attitude to it. A lot of vulgarity, a lot of like kind of inappropriate jokes, but ultimately the message I usually communicate, it's all about like those difficult subjects that most of us try to avoid dealing with, you know, things like vulnerability, trust issues, what our values are, where do we find meaning in our life, overcoming trauma and pain and anxiety, things like that. So yeah, I guess you could call it a Trojan horse.
And there's like a lot of really counterintuitive ideas in this book. Can you kind of give us a rundown of a few of them?
Sure. Don't believe in yourself, because you're usually full of shit. Failure is the way forward.
Don't try is one of them, right? It's like
don't try. The whole idea, so the don't try thing, there's a story about Charles Bukowski, a famous poet and writer, in the first chapter of the book. And he spent almost, I think, 35 years trying to become a published writer and failed at it.
Working at the post office, right?
Yeah. And then eventually he did. And he actually became very successful in his old age. And he was an interesting character. He was drank way too much and was just very a dysfunctional person. But he has this kind of amazing story that I think on paper is kind of like the American ideal. You know, it's like, oh, you just persist and work harder than everybody else, and then one day you too can like achieve greatness and success and all these things. And he was very much against that narrative. And on his tombstone, he put the words, "Don't try." And that's completely counterintuitive. But basically his point, and kind of the point I start the book out with, is that if you have to try to be something, then it means you're not that something. So if you have to try to be happy, you're basically just telling yourself that you're not happy. If you have to try to be confident, you're basically just telling yourself that you're not confident. And you get a little bit of this paradoxical thing where the more fervently you want to be something, the more you're just reinforcing in your head that you are not that thing and that you have not yet achieved that. And so I think what Bukowski would say and what I say go on to say later in the book is that it's not about trying. It's simply just about doing what feels important to you. And these whole ideas of success and fame and achievement, whatever, they're just psychological mirages that our brain invents and in many cases just mislead us. You know, it's like if you get the things right in your life, the success and the fame and all that stuff, the money, it'll kind of happen as a side effect, but it shouldn't be the focus. It shouldn't be like what's in front of your mind. There should be something else that you're focusing on.
It's like a kind of a message to sort of accept things as they are in a way. I think you say in there, like Bukowski just accepted that he was a loser by standard definitions and, you know, owned that.
Yeah. And then even when he sold millions of books, he refused to accept that this changed him in some way. You know, when he was a broke low life working in a post office, writing poetry at night drunk, he didn't let that define him just as much as, you know, selling millions of books and, you know, touring Europe and everything. He didn't let that define him either. And I think the lesson there is that there needs to be something more important. You know, it's like, ask yourself what can I find? Like, what can I do with myself, with my time or with my energy that I would still be happy doing whether I succeeded or failed at it, you know, regardless of these kind of external results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you're talking about, you know, if you like aspiring to be happy or wanting to be happy or wanting something, is like a negative, wanting a positive experience is a negative experience, right?
Right.
And experiencing a negative experience and kind of accepting it is actually a positive experience. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a
paraphrase.
Yeah. It's, I, it's referred to sometimes, Alan Watts called it the backwards law. And I, in my book, I call it the backwards law. It's that constantly pursuing more positive experiences will be itself a negative experience. And then simply allowing and embracing your negative experiences kind of paradoxically becomes a positive experience. And if you really kind of sit down and think about it, you see this in a lot of things. Like, it's like the people who become most successful in business are generally those who are most willing to accept failure. And people who become the most physically fit are the people who are able to endure pain. You know, people who have the strongest relationships are those who are able to deal with confrontations or conflict. So there's this weird kind of like yin yang thing going on here where the negative is what is actually the pathway to the positive. And pursuing the positive will just generate more negativity. And I kind of like throw the self-help industry under the bus for this by saying, you know, you're taking a bunch of miserable people or people who are struggling with their life and promising them like the shortcut to positivity. Whereas like their problem is not a lack of positivity. Their problem is that they've never learned how to deal with pain very well. And what I hope to do with the book is to teach them the tools to be able to handle pain well.
Yeah, it's kind of like an anti self-help book or something.
Yes.
Like it's I imagine that you're not big on positive thinking for positive thinking's sake.
Right. I mean, it's nice to be optimistic. I think that's totally great. But yeah, there's a part later in the book where I kind of take a big shit on positive thinking, like The Secret and that kind of stuff. Like it's, well,
there's a
I refer
point
to it
where
as,
positivity becomes delusion.
Right. I refer to it as delusional positivity, where it's like, it's better you know, if reality sucks, it's better to just deal with the suckage than to like try to convince yourself of something that doesn't exist, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, so that's, you know, one of the, some of the counterintuitive parts of the book. Any other parts of it that you feel are really counterintuitive that people at first, when they first hear it, are kind of like, what? What's going on? Al Bundy?
Yeah. I have a chapter called Why You're Wrong About Everything and So Am I. And it's the whole chapter basically makes the argument to like stop believing in yourself. It makes people squeamish, but once they work their way through the chapter, they actually tend to come out the other end like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. Basically, I make the argument. Well, let me back up a little bit. So, you know, I started blogging 8 years ago and I started focusing primarily on like personal development, psychology stuff like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And in the beginning, I spent a lot of time. I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to be like giving people advice, I should at least have like some semblance of knowledge of what the hell I'm talking about. So I spent a couple of years just reading tons and tons of psychological research, you know, just like diving into academic research, reading a lot of books, you know, about motivation and happiness and life satisfaction and all these different topics. And probably like the most transformative part for me, at least, of all that research was just the more I learned about psychology, the more I learned how flawed our brains are as humans. Like our brains are not, our brains did not evolve to deal with truth very well. Our brains evolved to survive. And in the case of like being a caveman for hundreds of thousands of years, it turns out that it's much better for survival if your brain can kind of like jump to assumptions,
heuristics, biases. It costs less to hear the rustling in the bush and believe that's a tiger and run than to not run and be wrong about that.
Right, exactly. So we have all these like mechanisms in our brains that help us make very quick decisions that probably helped us thousands of years ago. But when it comes to like an accurate understanding of a very complex 21st century world, they suck. And they particularly suck when it comes to like self-awareness, like having any sort of like objective perspective on our own behaviors and our own feelings and our own ideas. Like we're particularly bad at that. And this just blew my mind because this was like, well, crap, like I don't know what to believe anymore. Like I don't know if I can actually trust myself anymore. And I started to notice in my own life that this was actually kind of a good thing because, you know, when I look back at all the boneheaded things I've done over my own life, it usually came from the fact that I was very certain in certain assumptions I had. You know, when I look back at the mistakes I made when I was a teenager, it's because I thought I was right. I thought I knew everything. I thought I understood how the world works and I understood how people work. And sure enough, I got my ass handed to me over and over again. And there's no reason to think that that ever stops. You know, I think it's we become less ignorant as we age, but there's no reason to think that there's any end to our own ignorance. And so, you know, I talk about in that chapter that the same way we look back at, if you look back at yourself, say like 10 years ago, and you think about like some of the things that you believed and you thought were important, you probably kind of cringe and shake your head a little bit. You're like, oh my God, I was such a dork. What was I thinking?
If you've made any progress in your life, yes, it's probably the way that it looks.
Yeah. And what's interesting is 10 years from now, you and I will likely be sitting here thinking back to today, thinking, oh God, I can't believe I used to think that. Like, and so I think it's important to remember that and to not take your own assumptions and biases so seriously, to understand that they're imperfect and when you do this, it opens you up. First of all, it opens you up to learning and more curiosity, but it also opens, it also prevents you from like falling into a lot of traps of say like fanaticism or really intense prejudice, or really just making like really bad judgment calls. So in this sense, I kind of urge like a sense of self-skepticism, you know, believe in yourself less.
And were there any, you know, when you made these discoveries about the faulty nature of the human mind, were there any particular, this might be hard for you to access, but were there any particular stories or instances that came to mind where you, we were like, oh, that's like the perfect example of me not having a clue?
So my problem area personally has always been relationships. And I put, when I was younger, I talk about this in the book too. When I was younger, I became a little bit of like a playboy, to the point where it's like, it was unhealthy. Like I was partying too much, drinking too much, hanging out with girls that I didn't really like and probably didn't really like me. And I can look back now and see that like, I was just kind of, I wasn't in control of it. It was in control of me. Like it was this like insecurity that was driving me around women. But it's,
wait, what was, what do you think was like the fundamental error in there cognitively that like if it would have been possible to say anything to you that would have changed your perspective, then do you have any insight into what that might have been?
I mean, I think what drove me was I had a lot of like family issues, intimacy issues growing up. Like I grew up in a broken household and grew up with a single mom and had a lot of bad experiences around intimacy when I was young. And so I think that drove that, but I wasn't aware of that in my 20s. In my 20s, I told myself I had all sorts of like really warped beliefs about men, about women, about sex. Like I thought, and this kind of gets into the what we were talking about before we were live, about like the measurement of success, like how we decide to measure success. Like I honestly believed that like you had to sleep with a lot of girls or else you were a loser. You know, like I honestly believe that every man wanted to do this, but just most of them were like too afraid or like they were just pussies and like didn't like have the guts to like actually go out and do it.
That narrative is out there.
Yeah,
I mean, you
totally
get it pounded in your head in your 20s and teens.
Yeah, it totally. And I bought right into it.
Yeah,
I was totally receptive to it. I had a lot of like sexist beliefs about women. And so, yeah, it was like I had kind of this whole little ideology around it that took me years to kind of pick apart with the help of some therapy and some just like screwing up big time.
Nice CBT.
Yeah. but yeah, it was like, so I mean, that's my problem area, but I mean, everybody has kind of their own problem area. Everybody has their own like knots that they need to untie within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's very I think that we get rewarded for believing our cognitive biases or actually the a lot of the economy runs off of
our
cognitive biases and our faulty beliefs.
Totally. And it's easy, the easiest person to sell something to is somebody who's insecure about it. You know, it's you know, you don't want to sell beer by telling people, giving people like the facts of how it was brewed. You want to sell beer by telling them they'll have a good time and get laid. So like, that's why you see beer commercials with like 20 women dancing and partying and whatever. Like, it's just, they tap into like male insecurity, or the same with like makeup and women. Like you don't.
Like, yeah. If you're an advertising insecure person, in general, it never goes away. Like you get, you drink the beer, you have the party, you have sex with the women or whatever. And then, or you get the makeup, you get the dress, and you're like, you're still not that still doesn't feed you.
Right. Right. It's just that it just kind of like kicks the ball down the road, and then you feel like you need to buy even more next time or do even more. And I think, when I studied some marketing when I started my business, and like one of the first lessons you learn is like find the person's pain point and like kick them in it, like find their biggest insecurity and make them feel horrible and then offer your product.
Yeah, this is what I found, like researching copywriting or something, or whenever I talk to somebody who's they are a hired gun copywriter. It's like, well, how does that make that person feel really bad?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Like, I don't know. I don't really like want to go there. Like,
and I think it's like, I have friends in the marketing world, and I like one friend of mine. He always describes it as he's like, well, you got to sell them candy to give them vegetables. That's like kind of his rationalization for it, which I think is true in a lot of cases. Like there probably
are. You got to tell them that the book is going to show them how to not give a fuck so they can actually self-reflect and realize like how distorted their thinking is. And
but like, one point I made in an article recently is, if you think about like a culture today, like society today with the internet and TV and everything, like I think there's some study that said like the average person sees like, I think it's like 3,000 advertisements mm-hmm. in a day or something like that. And so it's just, I sometimes wonder like what the cognitive effect on a societal level is.
Oh, I feel it for myself. Like we were just talking about, I live in Colombia now, and you've spent a lot of time abroad. And this is one of the things I love about it, is that there's plenty of advertising. There's the benefit that it's in another language that I don't understand perfectly. And it's not, the advertising doesn't really understand me and my wants and desires the same way as that it might in the United States. But that's like one of the first things I notice when I go back to the United States is I get in the taxi cab and there's just a screen in front of my face.
Yeah.
Jimmy Kimmel on it, like, and some celebrity talking about materialist things. And then I start to feel like the insecurity starts to come back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's my fiance is Brazilian and she's, we just moved to New York about 6 months ago. And every time we watch TV together, she's like horrified by the commercials. She's like, how do they get it? Cause apparently in Brazil, they have a lot of rules about like what you can say and what you can't say. Hmm. And they also have a lot of rules about like what you can actually add. So like you can't advertise like pharmaceutical drugs. You can't advertise alcohol. And so she's just like constantly horrified by the commercials. Like, I can't believe they're allowed to put this on TV. Like, this is horrible.
Do you feel sad every once in a while? Ask your doctor about this pill.
Yeah, exactly.
Make you not sad all the time.
But it may cause stomach ulcers, brain cancer, diarrhea, fatigue.
Diarrhea.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So, I mean, yeah, you've spent a lot of time traveling, and I get the sense from reading all of your writing, and first of all, like I was just thinking about this earlier today, that like writing is such like a misnomer. It's like just, it's the biggest understatement about like what a person does when they write about almost anything, is that it's the living and the thinking that is the important and difficult part of writing that is worth reading. And so I get a sense from you that you have like a really good understanding about kind of how the world goes together. And I know you've done a lot of traveling, and I know I've experienced myself through travel a lot of self-realization and stuff, and continuing down that road all the time. So has the travel helped you have this sort of like matrix-like insight into the world and the biases and the BS that rules our behavior?
Totally. Totally. It's one of the most illuminating things that I've done. And I think it's just for the simple fact that when you go spend enough time in enough different cultures, you're just consistently amazed at how, first of all, things that you thought were unique to your country, everybody else does too. And then there are things that you thought everybody else does that are actually unique to your country. And so you keep having these kind of weird surprises. And it definitely changed my perception of, because it's that old question, like nature and nurture, right? Like what percentage of our behavior is just human behavior? It's like just natural human behavior. And then what percentage is like caused by our culture? And, you know, the more cultures you can insert yourself into and kind of try to integrate yourself a little bit, I think the more clear you can get about that question.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I guess, you know, now that I'm back in Medellin, one of the characteristics that I've noticed about like Chicago was that people just honk all the time. Like there's cars honking all the time for no reason at all. And now I've gotten back to Medellin, and I've made the trip back and forth so many times that, yeah, I've had this exercise over and over again of like, oh, people are like this in such and such place. And then I go back and realize, oh, no, people are kind of like that everywhere. I just didn't notice before. And now I'm like hearing cars honking in Medellin. I'm like, I don't remember that 3 years ago, like people honking for no reason. Or is it just my imagination? Have there been any things like that that you realized over time, specifics? Those are hard to access, but
they're
always interesting.
I mean, one thing I found very funny early on. So like when I started traveling in 2009, and I was like very excited at first. So I kind of did this insane itinerary of like a new country every 2 weeks or so. And I ended up visiting like 20 countries that first year. Eventually I learned to like calm the fuck down and take my time, you know, like Vietnam's not going anywhere.
Did you feel like you were a loser if you didn't see all of the countries? Is that kind of like,
maybe
the dating thing?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think I was just so like excited and like by the opportunity that I felt like I needed to take advantage of it immediately. But as time went on, I kind of chilled out and realized that, you know, things are going to be there. But one of the things I found really funny early on was every single country I went to, they would say, you know that saying about the weather that people say? They're like, oh, here in North Carolina, if you don't like the weather, just wait 10 minutes. You know, and like they think it's really funny because the weather is always changing. People say that everywhere in the entire planet. Like I've heard people say that in Thailand and Vietnam and Brazil and like, and they all think it's funny. They all think it's exactly where they live. They think it's like their spot on the earth is the one spot with the craziest
Medellin,
weather.
Medellin, where the weather's the exact same all the time. I don't know if you know, it's like you've lived here before. If the temperature drops like literally 3 degrees Fahrenheit, people are saying, oh, it's really cold today.
Yeah.
And then if it goes up like 3 degrees Fahrenheit, they're like, oh, it's really hot today.
Yeah.
And you know, I had a taxi driver the other day say, oh, the weather's really, really nice today. I'm like thinking, what are you talking? The weather's always nice. It's like, I grew up in Nebraska, man. You have no idea.
You have no idea. Exactly. You have no idea. I lived in Boston for 8 years. Like I used to have this argument with my Brazilian friends because like Sao Paulo in the winter, it gets down to like 60 and the summer it'll get up to like 85. And they consider that really, really hot and really cold. And I used to just tell him like, you don't know, you know nothing, Jon Snow. Like it's funny. That's I mean, and it comes back to like those perceptual biases we were talking about. It's like most people you ever meet, they've spent 99% of their time in the same spot. And so their perception of what varied weather is a certain thing. And they have no reference to compare it to. So they just like, oh, if you don't like the weather, just wait 10 minutes. You get it. There's a lot of little things like that that you just see everywhere.
I've noticed just coming back and forth to Colombia and in the United States, I usually find one thing that happens when I would like initially come to Colombia, or I guess I was in Argentina before, was just the first month or so was just me being very annoyed on a regular basis because things don't work, or I'm like trying to communicate with somebody and like that's tough because we're talking a different language, which of course then I have to like look at myself with that, because there's no denying that this person isn't just an idiot, that I'm not very good at speaking this language. And so there's a self-realization effect that goes on there. And then eventually I start to relax. And then I go back to the United States, and then I just get wound up all over again eventually.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. To me, when I was younger and I would travel to the third world, I would almost find it like a respite. Like I would find like, you know, everything moves slower. Sometimes things don't work, but like people are a lot more laid back. You know, they're a lot more interested in just kind of like hanging out at the beach or having like a 3-hour dinner than, you know, maybe like getting everything done on time. And it's funny, when I started traveling when I was 25 and I went to some of these places and I loved it. I was like, oh my God, this is great. Like, just chill out, open my laptop and work whenever I want, you know, go out to a beach party, you know, the things aren't a big deal. Oh, power went out today. That's fine. I'll just go find a cafe. And for a few years, like I really felt that. And then I come back to the US and I'm like, God, everybody's so uptight, stressed out. But as I got older, once I hit about 30, 31, it actually flipped. And I think what happened in my life is, well, first of all, my values changed. You know, when I was younger, my interests were very much just like getting out, exploring, learning about myself, learning about the world, partying, and meeting people. And so being in these kind of environments that are so laid back was better for that. And it was a more enjoyable experience. And work was kind of like a secondary priority for me. And then what happened when I was about 30 is my website started blowing up. My business started exploding. Suddenly I was making like really big decisions every day. The expectation for my writing was really high. So, you know, there was no more just like, you know, hammering out 500 words in a train station and calling it a blog post. You know, I needed to like sit down for hours and like have deep focused work. And it's funny because the third world started driving me crazy. And at the same time, I was less interested in partying. I was less interested, like I was familiar with the countries now. So there wasn't this like this whole excitement about exploring everything. So now it's like if the power goes out, like I'm pissed off. I'm like, I got shit I gotta get done today. And like, look, this isn't even just about me. I'm like not even being a hard ass. I got people who work for me. I've got an editor who's expecting stuff from me. Like, there's like I'm invested now, you know? And so actually my fiance and I, we did 6 months down in Brazil last year, and we both agreed. We're like, I think this is the last time we can do this. Cause like the internet would break and then you'd call a guy to come fix it and he'd come and he'd like hang out and like drink a Coke and talk to you for an hour about Carnival. And then he'd leave and he didn't actually fix it. And so you'd have to call again and then it would take three days for him to come back. And like, yeah, I was just like, you can't run a business this way. Like you can't, like there's just no way to like, you know, have a productive work life in this kind of environment.
It's funny hearing you say that. And we were just talking about the differences between Brazil and Colombia, or at least where I am before our conversation. But I feel like I am not that interested in partying and work is sort of my focus. But here in Medellin, it's like I can totally get in that zone and write and make that my focus. And there's just way less. When I was in Chicago, I felt like I was trudging through molasses all the time to get anything done. It took so long to get anywhere, or there's always so much noise going on and such. So it's sort of the opposite thing for me.
Medellin, it's like a magical place where you can have both. Cause it's like you can be super productive there. And it's the only place in Latin America that I found that, you know, you can have that like really quiet, productive lifestyle And then if you want to go out and do the party stuff, it's all right there too. Like the like the Latino excitement.
One little caveat being that, by the way, I don't have water this afternoon because
they told me
this morning as I was going to the gym, like, yeah, we're not gonna have water this afternoon. And that's not uncommon at all.
No,
it's just like once not a have month. Water. The internet goes down every 15 minutes. It hasn't interfered with the podcast much lately, but electricity will go out semi-regularly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Medellin's better than most places, but you still have some stuff like that. But it's just, I don't know, it's such a quiet, beautiful place to be, though. Like,
we're going to take a quick break. The other day I saw an ad for something that I wanted to buy, and I'm telling you, I was really ready to buy it on first sight. It was that cool. So I clicked on the ad, and then I waited, and I waited, and I waited. So I went back to Facebook, and I saw a bunch of cool stuff there. I saw a video of some people climbing on top of some tall buildings, and then there was this really interesting article about antibacterial soap. And, you know, I never did end up buying that product. Actually, I can't even tell you what it was. I forgot. You know, speed matters on the web. People want instant gratification. If they don't get it, they're always a click away from something more interesting, which is why I used to obsess with trying to get my WordPress site optimized. I would mess around with caching plugins and setting up a CDN and playing with image sprites. And, you know, there were a lot of other things I would have rather been doing with my Saturday nights, but it did work. My traffic went up and my revenue went up. And I wish I would have had this WordPress speed test tool back then. You just enter your website and you get a detailed report of just how fast your WordPress site is and easy steps you can take to make it faster. So go check it out. It's at wpengine.com/speedy. You're going to get a free speed test. That's wpengine.com/speedy. But I actually find it, this is something that I think relates to a lot of what you're talking about in the book, is that I find the reminder every once in a while that, like, hey, you don't have control over a lot of things. Like, stop trying to have control over some of these things and just relax and worry about the things that you can control.
Right. Totally.
One of the things that I learned.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And at least in my case with Brazil, I was like, well, I can control where I live and it's not going to be Brazil. All your Brazilian listeners hate me right now, but I think they understand. Like, things are not good down there right now.
It sounds like it was a lot more chaotic, you know.
It is much more chaotic than Colombia, unfortunately. Yeah.
So you and I think have found something therapeutic from travel. Now, I guess not everybody. I think sometimes people make excuses that they can't travel, but then there's other cases where it's really just not convenient or just doesn't work with somebody's life. Are there any things that people can do in their everyday life that can help them see their own misperceptions in the way that they're seeing in the world that's around them?
Well, I think ultimately, like, when we talk about the psychological benefits that we get from traveling, really what we're talking about is simply the benefits of putting ourselves outside of our comfort zone. And I think you can totally do that wherever you are. You know, that in the US, that might just be like going to a worse part of town and like volunteering at a charity. When I was traveling, when I was living in South America for so long, a lot of people in my family were like, wow, aren't you like scared? Isn't it really bad there? And I told them, I was like, you know, there are parts of the US that like were just as intimidating and just as bad. Like, it's not an all or nothing. And there are parts of South America that are absolutely beautiful and secure and really enjoyable to live. So like, it's not an all or nothing thing. I think really it's just challenging oneself to go out and experience something that you wouldn't normally experience, and that you wouldn't and that maybe you have some assumptions about that, you know, and be open to being shown that they're wrong. Not to get too political, but I saw an article, you know, with all this like Black Lives Matter stuff going on in the US, I saw an article like maybe 6 months ago, and it was citing research that it was like, you know, the average white person in the US has like, it's like only like 1 out of 7 white people in the US says that they have a black friend. And it's like with with black people, it's like similar statistic. Like it's basically the white people in the U.S. don't hang out with black people and the black people in the U.S. don't hang out with white people. And so I think a lot of the political, like the heat of the political debate around that is just from the fact that people don't actually know somebody. They don't actually go to that part of town and see how they live and like hang out and like,
yeah, I know, like yeah. taking up Latin dancing in Chicago definitely like mixed me up with a more diverse group of people than I would normally find myself interacting with. And I didn't have to leave the city to do that.
Yeah, just totally.
Like, one little hack that I used to do sometimes was I find myself always wanting to take the quickest route to get to my office or wherever I'm going to work. And so sometimes I would just like walk a different direction, like take a, it sounds like a totally silly thing, but you get stuck in patterns. And if you just break it every once in a while, I found an apartment that once that way, just like, yeah. Oh, the place is for rent. Oh, that's like, looks like a good apartment.
Yeah, that's true. I used to actually, when I lived in Medellin, I used to go on walks a lot, which kind of gets back into the a lot of a writer's job is not writing. I find that like walking, like walks are really good for thinking, and like walking to like new places or just like kind of wandering, finding new places.
Now, like, this may be besides the point, but are you strategic with your walks?
I am. So usually there's like some idea or like a glimmer of an idea that I have, but it's like, I feel like I need 30 minutes to sort it out in my head. But the thing is like when I'm sitting in my apartment in front of my desk, there's way too much distraction. So I like to try to get outside and like just really like mull over an idea or maybe a problem, like a big decision. It's like, it's really good.
There's going on there. Like when you're sitting there in front of the problem, there's all sorts of biases that are ruling your brain. There's like the, I don't know what to call it, but it's just whatever it is that's in front of you is suddenly like the most important thing in the world.
Yeah.
Especially when you're on a computer screen and there's all these different places you can go. Like the fact that you could, with a couple flicks of your fingers, go to Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a cognitive load on your brain that you're like not even aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's removing that suddenly. I mean, I don't know if you've ever messed with, there are a couple apps. One's called Freedom, but you can turn off all the internet, or you can turn off like portions of the internet for yourself. And I've played around with it in the past. I don't have like a steady habit with it, but it's amazing. It's painful at first. Like you find yourself like still typing in like Facebook, Gmail, you know, and trying to like do your little loop of checking everything. And it hurts to like see that blank screen come up because it's blocked. But what I notice on those days is that eventually after you kind of get through that like first hour of like twitching and withdrawal, I do start thinking way more clearly. And I've noticed on vacation too, actually, like when I started my business, I didn't take vacation for like 3 or 4 years because there was just so much work and I was already traveling so much. And then when I met my fiance, she convinced me to like go on like a bona fide, don't bring your computer vacation. And my God, I had like so many amazing ideas just like sitting on a beach. And I think it's just because there was like nothing to do. There was nothing to distract my brain from like focusing really hard on what was going on.
Yeah. It's funny when you do get back to the computer, then you're like, oh, I can't believe how fluidly my brain is working right now. Like what is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And as far as being strategic with walks, I guess I want to dig in that just a little bit. Then do you kind of like put in your brain a thing that you want to think about on your walk before you go on the walk?
Yeah. So it's usually like, I don't just schedule walks. Usually it's, if I've got something that's really difficult and I need to like think about it really hard for a while, it's like, oh, time for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I take headphones and music too.
And are there times of day where you wouldn't go for a walk because it's like a self-set rule that you wouldn't, or time of day that you will go more often? How does it work with your rhythms?
Yeah, I guess it usually ends up being in the afternoon sometimes. But I mean, way back when I was younger and I used to sleep a lot less and like I used to have crazy hours. I remember going on bike rides in the middle of the night to like just clear my brain, you know, just like decompress, think about life a little bit, relax a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're a bike rider, but anybody listening, like, you know, a bike ride at like 3 a.m. and in the city when there's no traffic, it is magical. It is like, there's nothing else like it.
That does sound nice. I mean, my part of Medellin, there's not really like bike lanes and stuff. So I'm always like afraid. I don't have a bike, but I imagine.
And the drivers down there are insane too. So
maybe just don't.
Yeah, just I wouldn't ride it. And with the mountains and everything, I think you're just asking for you're asking for pain.
people can read this article. I just want to touch on it quickly. Is it just me or is the world going crazy? I just happened across that article, sometime after we had already scheduled this interview, and I was like, oh man, this is good stuff. He's nailed it. I think if we can like summarize it for folks, they can obviously go read it, but.
Like a lot of people, so I have this like really dysfunctional relationship with U.S. politics. I think a lot of Americans have the same relationship where they hate it. They wish they were able to not pay attention to it. But like, I just find it impossible to not pay attention to it.
You can't look away. It's like watching a car crash or something.
And then there's like this voice in the back of my head where it's like, you have a civic responsibility to like vote for one of these people and support democracy. But it is so painful sometimes. But I watched the Republican National Convention a couple months ago. And like a lot of people, I was a little bit horrified. I don't really identify with either political party, but I've definitely been leaning more Democrat the last few elections just because I think they're less psychotic. But I was watching the RNC and it's just like every single speaker was getting up and talking about how like the world isn't safe anymore and you could die at any time and there's shootings everywhere and how like ISIS is coming to get us. And it was just pure fear and paranoia, like nonstop. And people were just like eating this stuff up. And if you kind of look at Trump's whole campaign, it's really, that's just kind of the entire strategy, is that there's a large percentage of the population that feels less safe than they did, say, like 8-10 years ago. And he's just kind of like, it's what we were talking about with the advertising. He's poking that insecurity and then saying, you need me to make everything right.
Right.
Again.
And this is exactly what you were saying. And yeah, I'm not very political myself, but I at least try to be rational. And sometimes I see things that aren't rational. And you describe in the article that, Trump is an effect, not a cause, right?
Right.
It's like, because things that are sensational get the most attention because of the way that we're all connected. He's hacking into that.
Right.
He's hacking into our biases and playing it off and using it against the very people who want to use it, for good things, but sometimes that ends up going too far to another realm of rationality.
So I've been fascinated with this topic for a while now, and I've written a few articles about it. And I think this one, Is the World Going Crazy, I think was the best one I wrote on it. But I've been fascinated about it too, because it's largely responsible for my career success. And that is the fact that the most extreme information on the internet, just the way the internet is built, how it feeds off of our attention, the most extreme and sensational information is what gets passed around the most. Mm-hmm. And that has some serious consequences, because you get, and whether it's with politics and things like gun safety, or with people who, I've written an article in the past about people who have developed like skewed perceptions in terms of like what success means, because everything they see on Facebook is like a 12-year-old, you know, making $1 billion with an app that he created or whatever. But it's this skews our perception. We're constantly bombarded with like the top 0.1% of like the most intense information. And most of us are spending all day connected to this stuff. And so it starts to skew our perception of like what is actually real or realistic and what's not. It's basically, it's grown. There's a segment of not just the US population, you're seeing this happen in most countries now, where there's a percentage of the population everywhere of people who are starting to feel just much less secure and safe, even despite the fact that crime is at an all-time low, wars are at an all-time low, poverty is at an all-time low, healthcare, life expectancy, they're at all-time highs. Despite these facts, people feel less safe. They feel like the world is like crumbling around them due to all this information that they're being bombarded with. And so you're getting a lot of demagogues like Trump in all these different countries who are just popping up and taking advantage of it.
Yeah, and these are things that you and I, as like you were saying, you and I as writers, we learn and our writing adjusts to take advantage of these things too. We're trying to do like the Trojan horse where, okay, this is the thing they're going to pay attention to, but this is the thing that I want to tell them, such as Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, or right. Like when I'm writing an article for Medium or something. Yeah, okay, I want to tell my story about moving to another country. Well, it's gotta be positioned in a way that somebody's gonna want to share it. So it becomes,
right.
Yes, you can leave the bubble that is North America. Like that's a strategic thing.
Right.
In some ways, it makes our writing better, but it's also something that can be hacked and it's scary when you look at the economics of it all, because as writers, we want more people to view our work. As a politician, you want to be in front of more people, good or bad. It seems to not maybe
matter.
Not matter.
Yeah.
And the way that the businesses like Facebook run is that people are going to spend a lot of time on Facebook.
Yeah.
And so like the economics just seems so stacked against,
yeah.
Against rationality, against being thoughtful and making sense.
Yeah. Well, I think, I'm still very much like pro all this stuff, all like technology and Facebook and everything. My take on it is that every new technology brings, it improves the quality of life for everybody, but it also brings newer, higher level problems with it. And with social media and the internet, this is our set of problems. And this is actually why, again, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, it is a personal development book, but I feel very, very passionate about these ideas, because I feel like these are the ideas that we need in the internet age. We desperately need to develop a healthy sense of skepticism. We desperately need to develop an ability to become okay with failure and shame, because everything's publicized now. Like people find out about everything. And so if you're trying to like hide your weak spots, or pretend that like certain things didn't happen, like you're just gonna, it's gonna get so much worse for you. So I think it's these tendencies. I think it the social media and the internet, it exacerbates a lot of these, like some of these worst tendencies that we have as humans. And we need to develop an awareness about them to like consciously fight back against them.
Yeah, because the economics of it, they're not going to like...
It's not going to change.
It's not going to just fix unless if individuals make, or we as a society make certain choices about making a distinction between, the same way we make a distinction now between junk food and something that's healthier.
Yeah.
Same thing goes for information, right? Like not all information is created equal. And we've got to recognize that.
Right. And the beautiful thing about the internet is that it's instant feedback. You know, there's actually, I've caught both the New York Times and the Atlantic, and I think the Wall Street Journal, I've caught them a few times now having like kind of a sensational headline.
Mm-hmm.
And then you click on the article, you know, so it'll say something like,
I mean something, it's something else other than what.
It'll be like, skipped your honeymoon, it means you'll get divorced. And like, you actually go and read the article and look at the research it's based on, and you're like, that's actually not what it means at all. Like, you just totally invented a headline that you knew would get people to click. And so I've started like calling those things out, commenting, and like on Facebook, I go to hide post, which when you do that, if you hide a post on your newsfeed.
Yeah, I do that. My newsfeed started to get a lot better now.
Yeah, not only does your newsfeed get a lot better, but everything you hide, Facebook recognizes that and it'll start showing it to fewer people. Because when you hide it, Facebook's like, oh, people don't like this. And so it'll actually get less reach. And so if enough people do that, these publications will stop being rewarded for that.
I mean, another thing I've done is I'll start trying to pay for things. Like I got a New Yorker subscription. There's on Patreon, there's some podcasters that I support. And now I noticed on your site, you have a beautiful layout, and people can subscribe for like a few bucks a month. And then they get access to your entire archive of content, if I'm understanding all this right. And then they also have like audio versions available of all of your content too. So,
yeah,
I mean, it seems like if that works, and I assume it is working out pretty well, then if people will start paying for higher quality information, if people will change their mentality that way, then maybe the economics can change and humanity can be better.
I think people need to, because it's, and actually Mother Jones posted a really kind of beautiful, I guess, plea about this. So they did an incredible investigative piece, like a 30,000 word investigative piece, where one of their reporters went undercover and became a prison guard at a private prison. And he wrote about it, and it was just all this horrifying stuff. And like just a lot of this like rot in the prison system. And it got a lot of attention, a lot of publicity. And actually the Justice Department came out and changed its policy about private prisons. So it actually like created policy change for the better that this guy went and did this, and Mother Jones published it. Mother Jones, and it started getting nominated for all these awards and all this stuff. And
that's like what journalism is supposed to do.
Yes.
It's like another arm of the government in a way.
Right. And Mother Jones posted an article. They said, you know, it's great having all this stuff. Like, this is more than we could have ever hoped for. But they said, let's be honest for a second. That piece, it took a year to write, and it costs, when you add up everything, it costs over $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
The revenue we made from the ads on that page was $5,000.
Wow.
And so they were like, there's just no way to do this anymore. And this is going to, you're going to see less and less of this, not just from us, but from everybody. As long as you're people are unwilling to pay for this stuff. And I mean, I ran into this to a lesser extent in my own work. I have two guys who work for me now. I literally get over 1,000 emails a week. My server costs, like just the cost, like I get more than 2 million visitors each month. So just the cost of like hosting it is probably as much as like a lot of people make in a year, like, or in a month. I've got books and I've got some courses and they sell well and everything, but it's like, as I'm getting older, and I'm spending more and more time and investing more into it, and I'm getting married and I'm starting to think about kids, and it's like, you know, it's all it takes is like an Amazon algorithm change or a Facebook algorithm change, and you know, my income could
Google
be half.
Google algorithm change too, yeah.
My income could be halved tomorrow. So I was like, I need some sort of like kind of base level support. And so I tried to create, and I didn't want to just ask people for donations because I don't think that's the answer too. I don't think we're going to enter into like the donation economy. I think it's people, we need to start. Unfortunately, when the internet was new, it trained people that they could get everything for free. And I think now it's like, we all need to get together and train people that like, if you want good stuff, because there's a lot of garbage out there, but if you want something good, you got to pay a couple dollars. And I think more people are becoming comfortable with that. But yeah, it's like, I look at the journalism industry, the music industry, and it's bad. Like, it's like, I would hate to be like a journalism major, you know, about to graduate. Like, mm-hmm. you've got like dozens of papers shutting down and consolidating. Like, it's just, there's no, like, that the economic models don't work right now.
Yeah, you just kind of hope that some entrepreneur will figure out how to crack the code and make good writing and good thinking economical. But yeah, for now there's books.
Yeah.
Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, for example.
Yes, which you can buy on Amazon and support my work. I was just going to say, like, thank God books are like okay. Because
it's an honest transaction. It's like very clear, like I'm giving you money for your thinking.
And it's also, unlike the others, it's like, it's hundreds of years old. So like, it's been around since like the 1500s. So it
looked
survived.
Like it might go away for a while, but it's not going away.
It's not going away.
Yeah. We'll get into some of the rapid fire questions here and wrap things up. What's the biggest compromise that you've made to get to this point in your life?
I'll say this. I mean, I don't know if this really counts. You know, when I started my websites, I had this idea of like, I read Tim Ferriss' 4-Hour Workweek and I was like, okay, cool. Like, I'll sell some stuff online, make some money, travel the world. And then like 3 or 4 years, I'll like move on to something else. And I always thought that thing was music. Like, I always thought, like, my first passion, my first love has always been music. So I always had this in the back of my head of like, okay, I'm going to do this for a few years and then I'll like come home and get really serious about music. And as things grew and became more successful and started meeting people and forming new relationships, I kept kind of delaying that dream more and more. And then I finally hit the point about 2 or 3 years ago where it's like, I had invested like 6 years to get to where I was. I had spent thousands of hours becoming a good writer. And I love writing. That I just had to kind of like be honest with myself and be like, it's never going to happen, man. Like, mm-hmm. you know, stop kidding yourself. Like, it's too late. You know, you jumped on the wrong train. Well, not the wrong train, but it's like, you can't go back. You know, it's like
let go of that part of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just let go of that dream, because it's probably not realistic anymore. And if you were actually going to do it, you would have done it years ago.
And because you made that decision, you can concentrate more on writing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
When's the time that you left money on the table in exchange for something else that was of value to you?
I've done that quite a bit, actually. I've got one guy who's been working. I have a tech guy who's been working for me for a long time, and I drive him crazy because I keep like shutting down. I've made a lot of courses over the years, and I keep shutting them down. Like when I stop thinking that they're good, even though they're making money, I launched one in like 2012, and by 2014, I'm like, this isn't good anymore. Like the new ones are better. So let's shut it down. And my guy's like, but it's making money. Like, why would you do that? I'm like, it's not good. Like, can't have it.
Not on brand or.
Yeah, I mean, well, and it starts to, because if you have products that don't live up to people's expectations, that also harms your brand as well. The other thing that I've always left money on the table is I don't do ads on my site, and I could probably make, maybe 100K.
2 million views a month at if it was a dollar CPM, that would be, $2,000 a month just at a dollar CPM, and I imagine you get a higher CPM than that. So
yeah, I'm leaving probably 50 to 100K on the table by not running ads on my site.
Yeah,
but again, it's like part of that. I see part of that is like the brand and the experience. Like I don't like running ads, and my readers don't like looking at ads. So I'd rather find other kind of more direct ways to monetize, like paying me for my archive, paying me for writing. That's what you like in the first place.
As a writer. So
What's
the last book that you read that's changed the way you saw something?
So I read Sapiens by, what's the guy's name?
He's got a complicated name.
Yuval Noah Harari. And there was one idea in that book that just blew my mind. He said that everything's a myth. He said, like, obviously you have like religious myths, but he said, like, for instance, the economy is a myth. The government is a myth. Yeah. Money is a myth.
Humanity runs off of our shared
beliefs
in mythical things.
Yeah.
Right.
And that we need those to survive. And that if enough people at any point stop believing in a myth, that society like collapses. Yeah. It just
dead silence.
Boom. Yeah. Just boom. That explodes.
Moving on. Do you make your bed?
No. My fiance does now.
Okay.
But I think she makes it for herself, not for me.
Yeah. Do you have a final message for our listeners who are trying to define and achieve their own version of success?
Final message. There's a lot of times people like podcasts like this, they ask me for like quotes. So when you asked me that, like I just immediately thought of a quote I say sometimes. I believe it's in the book. But it's a quote from Freud, and he said, one day in retrospect, the years of struggle will strike you as the most beautiful. And I love that. Because I love the idea of being able to find beauty in, I guess, things that are a little bit painful. But I also think it's true too. It's usually like the most meaningful things that happen in our lives are often the most difficult. And when we're in the middle of that difficulty, it's hard to remember that. All we want to do is like, oh God, I wish this was over. But when you're done and you look back, you're like, wow, that was really amazing.
Yeah, that was worth it.
Yeah.
This is a theme that is in a lot of your writing and in your new book, and something I've tried to talk about here. It's love your work. It's not do what you love. It's like find some pleasure in the act of working.
I like that. I actually didn't immediately notice that, but I really like that.
Oh, you were like, oh, this is some do what you love.
Yeah, like find your passion.
No, that's the Trojan horse.
Yes. Yeah. Nice. I like it.
And where can people get more of you, Mark?
MarkManson.net. And then, as I've said a million times, the book's called Subtle Art Not Giving a Fuck. It will get you, sneakily get you to reevaluate your values and the meaning in your life. And it is available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all booksellers.
It's good that we mentioned it a lot of times because I interviewed Noah Kagan recently and he said you have to mention something 7 times.
Oh,
so I think we probably got to 7.
Well, just in case, the book is called Subtle Art Not Giving a Fuck. It's on store shelves September
3rd. What extra work?
Just in case.
All right, thanks so much for coming, Mark. This has been great. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by Audible, and they'd like to give you a free audiobook. Choose from over 180,000 audiobooks on any subject you can imagine. Just go to cadvy.net/audible to claim your free audiobook. I hope you got a lot out of that conversation with Mark Manson. I think he really has a deep understanding of the mechanics of life, and I think that he's built much of that understanding through travel. So for more about self-discovery through travel, check out Jody Ettenberg on episode 23. She quit her job as a lawyer, and now she travels around the world writing about food. Pretty awesome. And before I go, I've got to ask, do you like books? If you do, sign up for my book recommendations. About 90% will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to cadvy.net/reading and get the first set of recommendations right away. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadvy. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by the Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Cadvy, Inc.